Okay, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. Feels great to be back in Toronto. Some of you might not know, my first job out of India was here at Toronto. This was my first postdoc. And I was Kumar and Fiona's postdoc. And I came in here yesterday and I was kind of walking around Yonge Street feeling very nostalgic about about Toronto. And I realized that it's 10 years. So my 2001 was when my job here got over. Okay. So I want to talk about special values of automorphic L functions. So Ramamurthy has actually already paved the way for much of my talk. So I wanted to start with prehistory, Riemann zeta function, Dirichlet L function. So all that is done. Okay. So now So I was afraid of something like that happening. What if this goes into this pocket? You need a Vulcan ear or something for this. All right, so I want to start to kind of set the stage with a certain classical theorem. This theorem is in the world of modular forms and L functions of modular forms. It's independently due to Manin and Shimura. And with this theorem in the background, I'll kind of build up a certain story about L functions and L values. So the theorem goes as follows. I'm going to let phi be a weight k holomorphic cusp form for gamma naught n, or gamma naught n, so level n and some Nebenchippers, which doesn't really matter for this talk. And I'm going to assume this is primitive. So there is a certain baggage of notation and information there. So anyway, so this is basically all that I'm saying is take a modular form, and this jing-bang of words simply says that I'm in the right arithmetic context to do something about, to prove something about L values. Okay, so take such a thing. This theorem says that there exists a couple of numbers. I'm going to follow Shimura's notation, say u plus and u minus, non-zero complex numbers, such that if I take any integer m, but not really any integer, with 1 less than or equal to m less than or equal to k minus 1. So this string of integers are the points plays an analogous role to the L function of phi as what the even positive integers and the odd negative integers play for the Riemann zeta function. These are what are called the critical points. So it's here, this definition has got to do with poles of the gamma function that you see on either side of the functional equation. Anyway, so there's a certain set of points where you can hope to prove something interesting. Although for non-critical values, there's an entirely different story. So everything I have to say in this talk is about critical values. I have nothing to say about non-critical values. And also, we can keep this in mind that everything I have to say comes under this general umbrella of Deligne's conjecture about critical values of motivic L functions. I have nothing to say about Bloch-Kato conjectures, which are, start where pretty much Deligne's conjecture starts. Anyway, so take a modular form. There are two numbers such that for any one of these points, and for good measure, let me take a Dirichlet character. And so for all chi, Dirichlet character. If I look at the L function, okay, so what's the L function? So I got this phi, there's a Q expansion, summation ANQ to the N. I'm going to look at the L function of phi twisted by chi. This, by definition, as a Dirichlet series, is AN chi N by N to the S. There is a well-working, well-oiled machinery, analytic theory of these L functions. It's all due to Hecker. And I want to take this L function, look at the value at one of these critical points. Then the theorem goes that this L value is up to quantities. So I'm going to use this tilde notation in the sense that, we have already seen that zeta 2 is pi squared by 6. In this talk, I'm going to be suppressing that 6 and simply write zeta 2 is up to, for the Riemann zeta function, the field at hand is rational numbers, is up to something rational is pi squared. So So this is what Delim predicts. This 1 over 6, an explanation of what the 6 is what Bloch-Cartu conjectures do. Okay, so I'm brushing this 1 over 6 and really Bernoulli numbers later on all under the carpet. So really one is focusing on these kind of, the analog of pi squared. So the value of L function of a modular form twisted by character is up to quantities where quantities in the field, the rationality field of phi and chi. So what do I mean by that? So you take such a primitive form. By primitive, I mean eigen form, new form, normalized. Okay. In such a situation, if I define this field Q phi, one may call this the rationality field of phi. This is the field that you get by adjoining all the Hecke eigenvalues. Fact, this is a number field. And by Q phi chi, I adjoin further the values of chi. So the theorem goes that this is a power of 2 pi I. One of these two periods, there's a certain recipe there, to which period to pick, and Gaussian. Or more generally, as we saw in this, the way Ram put down Coates and Lichtenbaum's theorem, there is a Galois equivalent way of stating this. This L value divided by everything you see here is a certain algebraic number, and that algebraic number is well behaved under Galois Q bar over Q. The Galois equivalent version implies this slightly weaker statement here. Okay, so these are the sort of theorems I'm going to be talking about. So before I go any further, I want to restate this theorem. So here is the same theorem. I'm going to call this a neoclassical rendition of the same thing. Grapevine has it that this phrase neoclassical in this situation is due to Jacquet. Classical is modular forms, and neoclassical is if I talk about automorphic representations. So the same theorem, the content is the same, the words will be different. So now I'm going to let pi be I'm going to deliberately leave some space, cuspidal automorphic representation of GL2 over Q, so GL2 AQ. Now you know that the cuspidal automorphic representations of GL2 come in two types. They either correspond to holomorphic modular forms or they correspond to mass forms. This theorem is all in this holomorphic world. So there is a certain way in which I can throw out the mass forms and just focus on the holomorphic case. I'm going to consider what are called cohomological cuspidal automorphic representations. So I'm going to give you a definition of this after I get done with stating the theorems. This, just like taking a cusp form and asking that cusp form to be primitive, eigen form, new form, etc., puts me in the right arithmetic context. Likewise, this puts me in the right arithmetic context. What do I mean, the right arithmetic context? I want to go towards theorems like this. Okay, so then there exists two numbers. I'm going to call them P plus and P minus, non-zero complex numbers, such that one, if S equals half, is critical. Now, so far, in all the talks, Dirichlet L functions, Artin L functions, Riemann zeta function, Shimura, Manin, the critical points were integers. But in the automorphic world, and for automorphic L functions, there's an unfortunate issue. One has to look at half integral or sometimes integral values. It depends on GLN, the parity of N. So this is just a little aside here. There is this world of automorphic forms, and there's this world of motives. There is some dictionary between these two. And in this dictionary, if a pi here corresponds to a motive M, there's an unfortunate shift which has to do with half the sum of positive roots for GLN, if I'm talking GLN. something like that. So it's this shift which makes me look, and I'm working with GL2, makes me look at half integral points. Okay, so let's say half is critical, then the value, the central critical value is up to quantities in the relevant rationality field, sum 2 pi i to an integer which depends entirely on the representation at infinity, equivalently entirely on the weight of the modular form, times p plus. And now I can do any critical point. If s equals half plus n is critical, and I take a Dirichlet character, but I'm going to talk in the Edelic setup. So for any finite order Hecker character, chi, if I look at the value at half plus n of pi tensor chi, this is up to quantities in a relevant number field, 2 pi I to the d infinity plus m, one of these periods, and Gaussian. Which period I pick depends on the parity of m and the parity of chi. So it's going to look like minus 1 to the m chi minus 1. So the theorem on this board is entirely equivalent to the theorem on that board. It's just different words. So what I want to do is give you some idea in this talk of how one proves a theorem like this. So there are many issues to focus on, so I want to kind of deconstruct this theorem. So to begin, one needs to, well, lay one's hands on what are these. What are these numbers? So that's the first problem. Where do these numbers come from? Or the definition? What's it got to do with L values and so on? So these numbers, I'm going to use the word period. But unfortunately, this word period is an overused word. Last week, I was giving a talk at Arbeitstagung in Bonn, which was also Zagier's 60th birthday conference. And both Zagier and Konsovich were there. And of course, they had to ask me, what has this got to do with their periods? So I don't think these are periods in the sense of Zagier-Konsovich. At any rate, I'm going to use the word periods. Maybe a better word might have been regulators once I show you the definition of what these numbers are. At any rate, so I'm going to beg the audience's indulgence for me to, let me use this word period. So that's the first thing, what are these numbers? Second is to go from 1 to 2. These are what are called period relations. This part of the story, as you will see, or maybe as you will not see, this is the part I won't really talk so much about. But anyway, this part has really got nothing to do with L values. I'm going to define some numbers using the data at hand, which is a representation equivalent to a modular form. One can prove something about these numbers via a proof which has really got nothing to do with L values. And third part, well, you've got to do something with L functions. That's the third part. Can I prove this? So, in trying to deconstruct this, 1, 2, 3, 1 are, what are these periods? Oh, by the way, so I have to make a comment here. It's about notation. Now, in representation theory, it's kind of traditional to use the symbol pi for a representation. So I'm given to understand this goes back to Frobenius. Pi coming from P, coming from permutation. But to do special values, there's also this God-given pi, okay, 3.14159, etc. And you want to use both. So that's a capital pi, and there's a little pi. Okay. To some, it is a little jarring to the eye, but very quickly you'll get used to it. Okay, so back to this. So one first problem is, well, what are these periods? Second, to prove period relations. The period relations in this context is going to take the form that I look at one of these periods, epsilon can be either plus or minus, and I twist it, take the representation twisted by a character and ask myself, what are the periods of the twisted representation, how do they relate to the periods of the representation I start with? One proves a statement like this. let me just stop here and say something about the period relations. Exactly, yeah. So, so what kind of information is embedded in these period relations? So let me maybe go to this board. So this, I was going to start my talk with some prehistory, so this is the part of the talk which I decided not to give since Ram had already, you know, done much of the work. Well, one can say that the subject of special values of L functions starts with this series. Now you know that in the history of mathematics, this was an open problem to sum the series. It was an open problem for more than 100 years. It went by the name the Basel problem. So apparently people like Leibniz couldn't sum the series. Anyway, we know Euler did it, and it's pi squared by 6. And in this talk, up to some rational, it's pi squared. Yeah? Now I'm going to take a related series. Okay, so here's my related series. 1 minus 1 over 2 squared minus 1 over 3 squared plus 1 over 4 squared plus 1 over 6 squared minus 1 over 7 squared minus 1 over 8 squared plus 1 over 9 squared plus 1 over 11 squared, and so on and so forth. If this series converges, it's measurized by that. There's a pattern, clearly. I've deleted 1 by 5 squared, 1 by 10 squared. I'm going mod 5. I got a bunch of signs. The pattern is plus, minus, minus, plus. I'm looking at the quadratic Dirichlet character mod 5. Up to quantities in the relevant rationality field, so Q adjoint the values of chi, but it's quadratic, so Q adjoint plus or minus 1 is just Q, up to really Q cross, it's pi squared times square root of 5. What is the square root of 5? It is the Gauss sum of the quadratic Dirichlet character mod 5. You can work this number out, it's 4 over 125 or something. The point of the period relations is, if I know zeta 2 is pi squared, automatically I know the critical values, at least in this part of the critical values, of Dirichlet L functions. Further, period relations can be proved for all what are called algebraic Hecker characters. That means, okay, by the way, this period relations is GL2, is a GL2 story, GL2 onwards. Doesn't really give this, but this is just a moral example. If the story made sense for GL1, it's saying that if I know zeta 2 is pi squared times a rational, automatically I know zeta 4 is pi to the 4 times a rational, zeta 6 is pi to the 6 times a rational, so on and so forth. Automatically I know critical values of all Dirichlet L functions, in the sense that up to something in Q chi, it is the right power of pi and this Gauss sum. So, well, there's still the third part. I still got to explain how you prove something for L half pi being whatever it is. Usually this part of the story has to do with at least one approach to special values, has to do with it is about giving a cohomological interpretation to some analytic theory of L functions. In this case, I got this L function. How do we get this L function? It's the Mellin transform of the modular form. So you want to cohomologically interpret the Mellin transform. I'm going to explain this. So in this talk, I want to give you some idea of how these periods are defined and how one proves a statement about central critical value. If you set this up right, this is what I was, you know, Henry and I were having this conversation. If you set the story up right, there is no difficulty in writing down the same story over a totally real number field. And so, reference. So this is my student Naomi Tanabe, and I wrote this paper pretty much to teach ourselves the story in the context of GL2 and classical L functions. It's called Notes on the Arithmetic of Hilbert Modular Forms. It's going to appear in the Journal of Ramanujan Mathematical Society sometime soon. So, and we work on a totally real number field, and it's just, there's no extra difficulty. So, for instance, Shimura wrote this theorem, this paper for modular forms, and then he redid the entire thing for Hilbert modular forms, and it, you don't see the difference. Oh, okay. I don't know. So it's not clear. I will. We will talk. How about we will talk about it? Yeah. Okay. So this is my first part of the talk, really, setting up the kind of theorems I'm interested in. So the next 30 minutes I'm going to spend on, you know, how these numbers, how do you define them, and say something about the proof. So what are these numbers? So I guess this is the third part. Periods. First let me maybe put down a meta definition. This is in the spirit of the, you know, the abstract of this conference, that you want to understand periods in the most generalized sense of the word, period. So here's the meta definition. The bare bones linear algebra underlying the definition is going to be something like this. We'll have a complex vector space. Actually, we'll have two complex vector spaces and an isomorphism. Call this something, say F. And there will be a certain subfield of complex numbers, a number field floating around. This number field will be one of these rationality fields, the Q pi, or the Q phi, the field that you get by adjoining all the Hecke eigenvalues. So that's this field. And let's say V0 is an F subspace. It's not just an F subspace, but it's an F structure. Okay, so what do I mean by an F structure? V0 is an F structure for V. If the canonical map from V0 tensor C over F to V is an isomorphism. This means, well, for surjectivity, I need enough F vectors for surjectivity. But if I had too many F vectors, then injectivity will fail. So, you know, just about right F vectors. If I'm just talking about vector spaces, what is an F structure? Well, take a basis and take the F span of the basis. That's going to give me an F structure. But these guys won't be just vector spaces, but will be irreducible representations of some group that is going to be acting on them. Now, whether there is an F structure or not is serious. I want this V0, so that's first condition. Second condition is V0 should be G stable. And this is not for free. Let's say I'm in a situation where I got an irreducible representation of a group and really two different realizations of that irreducible representation. And let's say I got F structures on both sides. Then by some general principle of these F structures, I can look at, under this isomorphism, see what happens to this F structure and compare it with the F structure on the other side. And there is a certain uniqueness principle, because this is an irreducible action. Irreducibility of that action is going to say that any two F structures are unique up to homotheties. In other words, they will exist in any such situation, they will exist a certain number P, such that, so call it something, P of F maybe. So this is going to be a non-zero complex number. So this is the bare bones linear algebra which will underlie period constructions. And this Borel's paper, which the questioner asked, the Borel's regulators are defined roughly like this. Okay, so he's looking at certain cohomology of SLNZ. And okay. All right, so in my situation, these periods, one may call these periods as Betti-Whittaker periods. This phrase is suggestive. Betti, there's some cohomology theory at hand. That's going to give me one of those vector spaces. And the Whittaker, there's a certain Whittaker model, a certain realization, certain model for the representation space. That's going to be the other side. and somehow we can compare the two. This comparison is going to be in the automorphic world, the Eichler-Shimura isomorphism, and you know, you put everything in place and you will see a certain number popping out. That's going to be the period. Okay, so I want to show you this definition. And the same definition, one can make sense of a similar definition for higher GL. So here is the Betty part of the story. My group at hand is GL2. I'm going to consider the space SGKF. Let me define this. This is the space of double cosets GA mod GQ mod K infinity circle KF. Okay, what is this? K infinity is the maximal compact at infinity. It's going to be O2. Except for a technical reason, I'm working with GL2, I want to throw out the center. I'm going to patch on the center here. And K infinity circle is a topological connected component. And it's a trivial exercise that it's SO2 and positive reals. And K infinity mod K infinity circle is really Z mod 2. This Z mod 2 is going to be acting on many things inside, many things that you'll soon see. And it is this which is going to pick up the two different periods. What kind of space is this? Well, this is basically, I'm working with GL2, GL2R mod positive reals, so it's really upper half plane as well as the lower half plane. And this, oh, I didn't say what KF is. KF is a level structure, so it's an open compact subgroup of GAF. So this is roughly like upper half plane mod a discrete subgroup as well as so disjoint union, lower half plane, modular discrete subgroup. So two copies. Okay. A modular form lives on that. It as well as lives on this. And you can, there's always a choice that you can make. And this choice is what gives us this plus or minus. Okay. So that's my space at hand. I'm going to let T be the diagonal torus. I'm going to let lambda be a dominant integral weight for this torus. So this just means it's a couple of integers. Lambda is just a pair of integers. Dominance is, say, A is bigger than or equal to B. And what kind of character is this? It sends a diagonal T1, T2 to T1 to the A, T2 to the B. And I'm going to let E lambda be the irreducible representation of GL2, of the algebraic group GL2 with highest weight lambda. If I want to work with weight k modular forms, then just to tie up with the classical story, for a weight k modular form, the lambda is going to be k minus 2 times half the sum of positive roots for GL2. So if I did weight 2 modular forms, I'm looking at trivial coefficients. This is actually if k is even. As integers, it's going to look like k minus 2 by 2 and minus k minus 2 by 2. Okay, so to this irreducible, there's a finite dimensional representation of GL2. Associated to this is a sheaf. Let E lambda tilde be the sheaf on this space SGKF. This SGKF, some people will call it a locally symmetric space. It's not quite a locally symmetric space in the sense of differential geometry, but it's almost there. So just a space. So what is the sheaf? Let me show. Yeah, exactly. No. So I'm soon going to look at sheaf cohomology, and you know, just I'm working with the category of sheaves of Q vector spaces over a topological space. It could be that this is a Shimura variety. I don't care. Yeah. So Borel set compactification will play a very serious role, which will not be mentioned in this. So at one point I will mention Borel set, but no. Okay. So let me show you a quick definition of the sheaf. How does this work? Well, let me look at this example. Upper half plane. You take the upper half plane and you take this just the set theoretic product of the upper half plane with this the representation space, the Q vector space. I can project down to the upper half plane. Now bring in your discrete subgroup. The discrete subgroup acts on the upper half plane via Mobius. It acts on this Q vector space via the representation. So there's a diagonal action on this product. Go mod it. And projecting to the first factor induces this map. So call this something, I don't know, vibration if you want. And I'm going to look at the sheaf of sections of this vibration. This is my E lambda filter. So I'm interested, so in consider the cohomology of this space with coefficients in the sheaf. There's an entire subject which tries to understand these kind of cohomology groups. That subject goes by the name cohomology of arithmetic groups. It's pretty much the same up to some isomorphisms as the cohomology of the discrete subgroup with arithmetic group gamma, the coefficients in that module. Although I'm going to work in the context of sheaf cohomology. So this is just so I want to understand these cohomology groups. I'm going to put on a certain diagram. As I put on this diagram, I'm going to keep saying things, kind of qualifying this diagram. To understand the definition of periods, there is one diagram that I'd like you to take home. And to understand the proof of that central critical value, there's going to be yet another diagram. These two diagrams are really the crux of this talk. So let's look at this sheaf cohomology group. The cohomology of this SGKF, upper half plane mod gamma, with coefficients in the sheaf. Now, how do you compute sheaf cohomology? You take the sheaf, you resolve it. You take global sections. Forget that first term or zero term, whatever you call it. And then take the cohomology of that complex. But there's a choice of your resolution. Any acyclic resolution will work. I can work with thinking in terms of differential forms. And if I think in terms of differential forms, well, so to do that technically, I got to tensor this up with C. So think of differential forms on H mod gamma with coefficients in this bundle. Pushing that idea, there is a standard isomorphism. This sheaf cohomology group can be identified with relative Lie algebra cohomology with coefficients in smooth functions on GM or GQ. And the moment you see that, you know that there's some automorphic forms floating around in the background, tensored by this coefficient system E lambda. Okay. What is Lie algebra cohomology or relative Lie algebra cohomology? This is the Lie algebra version of group cohomology. And then a relative, there's this GK module kind of story. Now let's look at this coefficients. I got smooth functions on GM or GQ. Inside this sits the space of cusp forms for the group G. So I can look at smooth cusp forms sitting in here. This inclusion of smooth cusp forms in all smooth functions induces via theorems of Borel and Borel-Franke an inclusion in cohomology. Well, the space of cusp forms decomposes for the action of GA into a direct sum of cuspal automorphic representations. I'm looking at cohomology. Oh, by the way, there's some level structure, KF, so I've got to take KF invariance. So I've fixed the level. I've fixed the representation type at infinity. So that's like saying I've fixed the level N. I've fixed the weight K. The only finitely many, the space of weight K modular forms of level N is finite dimensional. In terms of representations, the only finitely many representations which can have level KF and infinity type determined by lambda. So this is a finite direct sum of, only a finite bunch of representations can contribute. Cohomology commutes a direct sum. So this is going to be the direct sum of a finite set of cuspidal automorphic representations. And I'm looking at relative Lie algebra cohomology at infinity. So such a pi factorizes pi infinity and everything else. So I take the pi infinity, this cohomological mumbo jumbo is happening only at the representation is infinity, and I throw out the rest of it. So there is such a decomposition. At some stage you got to, you know, just take this as a black box. Let me tie this up with something in the classical world. This was sheaf cohomology here. I went across thinking of relatively algebra cohomology and then automorphic forms thereof. Inside that was a space of cusp forms. So there is some part of global cohomology which is computed in terms of cusp forms. And that subspace is what's called cuspidal cohomology. So this is that subspace sitting here, which is isomorphic to those cohomology classes. If you think in terms of differential forms, are represented by cusp forms. This definition is originally due to Eichler and Shimura. Although their language was somewhat different, but it is due to them. Okay, so now comes all this actually works for any connected reductive group and etc. So now keep in mind I'm working with GL2. The cohomology degree that I'm going to look at is cohomology classes in degree 1. On these groups, there is an action of my group of connected components, which is O2 mod SO2. There's an action there of O2 mod SO2. So for cohomology in degree 1, for GL2, for representations at infinity, you just sit down, look at the representations of GL2R. This is totally standard here. And one knows that for cohomology in degree 1, for a representation which can possibly have cohomology, namely the discrete series representations, this as an O2 mod SO2 module has both the trivial character, which I'll call, say, epsilon plus, and the non-trivial character, and both appear exactly once. Or in other words, this decomposition can also be written as a direct sum over pi's, which can possibly contribute. There's a pi f, either with a plus or with a minus. In the classical world, in Eichler-Shimura isomorphism, you will often see that the cohomology for a discrete subgroup is a space of cusp forms, direct sum, you know, all the complex conjugates. Sk direct sum sk bar in Eichler-Shimura. This is the sk, that's the sk bar. So this is the Betti part of the story. So this is one of these vector spaces. And where is the rational structure? Well, you've got to rethink this entire story, starting with sheaf cohomology. I made a choice of resolution here, thinking in terms of differential forms. Well, I could think in terms of singular cohomology. So I take a singular complex. Now that is a story which works over Z. You know, you take the free abelian group on the symplices and you kind of build it up from there. So there is a rational structure there coming out of singular cohomology. And so here is a certain vector space. It's decomposing as a direct sum of subspaces. These are not just random subspaces. These are with irreducible action of GAF. So I got this complex vector space, which defines value over Q because of singular cohomology. The Hecke action, the GAF action, so there's C, this is a rational subspace. It kind of picks up. For each summand, you've got to go a little up. The bare bones linear algebra is, think of one endomorphism of a complex vector space. Okay, so let's say I got T in NV. Say it's semi-simple. Okay, that means it's diagonalizable. Well, it stabilizes a rational subspace. Okay, so I got an n by n matrix with entries in Q, and it's semisimple. Its eigenvalues are roots of the characteristic polynomial, and those are all algebraic numbers. If I want to look at the eigenspace corresponding to one of these lambdas, to split this off, I need to go up till just the field generated by lambda. So if I did this, then I can split off V lambda plus some rest of it, which I don't care. So this is the kind of situation. Each of these summands get defined over a slightly bigger field than Q. How big? This big. So that's where one of the rational structures is coming from. So this is the Betti part of the story. Now let me show you the Whittaker part of the story. let me motivate this. Let's go back to the world of modular forms. So I got this weight k cusp form, some level, some Nabentropus, and it's primitive. Okay, it's got a Q expansion. And let's say ans are the Fourier coefficients, so summation an q to the n. If I take a complex automorphism, so that means an automorphism of the field C, I can define a function sigma phi by simply hitting the Fourier coefficients by sigma. That's a Q expansion. There is no reason why it should be even modular. In fact, sigma phi is a cusp form of the same level, same weight, with Nabentropus sigma omega, and it's also primitive. This is, I think, Yurishimura or. Yes, so what exactly? So what is happening? This space of cusp forms of a given level has a basis consisting of forms with integer Fourier coefficients. And so you take your phi, you write this in terms of that basis. But to prove that, actually you prove this. This is kind of, ultimately these are equivalent. So I want to do the same thing for representations. So I'm going to start with this cuspal automorphic representation phi. I'm going to look at the finite part. This is really the finite part of the representation, this one. I'm going to look at what's called the Wiedeker model, which depends on a choice of an additive character psi, and psi s is the finite part of that. So psi okay. I want to show an action like this. You know, I want to make sense of something like this. So given any xi, say a Wiedeker function, I'm going to send xi to sigma xi. This is a function which is defined as, okay, I want to define this. So to do this, I need to do a little bit of something. So this is what I do. I consider this group of all automorphisms of C. This, by the way, is a humongous group. Really, ultimately, no one cares so much about this group. But by restriction, this maps onto the Galois group of the absolute Galois group of Q. Well, I can go further down. I can go down to Galois Q adjoint all roots of unity. And what is this group? Well, there's an inverse limit of all the Galois groups of finite cyclotomic extensions. That's the inverse limit of all Z mod and Z cross, Chinese remainder, etc. This is isomorphic to the product of ZP cross, or all primes P. And this is finite ideals, fits inside finite ideals. In other words, if I'm given myself a sigma there, that gives me an element T sigma here. This T sigma can be used to give an action of odd C on the Wiedeker model. So this, the Wiedeker function is defined as, I apply sigma to xi on T sigma inverse 1. This is, you've got to cook this up, define something like this. And then one can check that this map really is a map from the Wiedeker model of pi to the Wiedeker model of sigma pi, but psi has been left unchanged. This is the exact analog of Q is left unchanged, and I've hit the Fourier coefficient by sigma. So this is the right thing to do automorphically. Observe that if I have a rational structure, then I can get an action of odd C on this vector space by making it act on the second factor. So if V naught tensor C, I consider this isomorphism, you know, C acts on the second factor. And I can retrieve the rational structure. I can retrieve this by taking invariance under odd C over F. Conversely, here I'm going the other way around. I've defined an action of odd C, and then one checks that there is a rational structure on the Wiedeker model, W pi F, let me say circle. This is taking the full Wiedeker model and taking invariance under odd C over the relevant, Q pi. You've got to prove that there are some invariants. If there is an invariant vector, then I know that it will generate a rational structure. And to prove this, there's actually some nice finite, some p-adic group representation theory which goes in here. One has to identify there is a certain theory of what are called local new vectors, which is very useful here to prove that there is a certain rational Weddigal function. So that's the other side. And I need this comparison. Maybe I can do it here. This comparison isomorphism, which will then give me the period, is feels actually like a trick. So the comparison map how does this work? I got the Weddigal model. From this, for each possible sign, now keep in mind this H1, maybe I will, okay, of the representation at infinity, which is a discrete series representation, this plus or minus is one dimensional. That's what I'm saying here. So you fix the basis of this one dimensional vector space. It depends on. There's something which, you know, a few years back when I was just getting to know Harder, he told me that if you want to do special value of L functions, you have to learn the art of fixing a basis for a one-dimensional vector space. And in some sense, ultimately, it's true. One can reformulate this picture so that you just have two one-dimensional vector spaces, and you have two different ways to go from here to there. And a comparison of these two really gives, you know, the theorems of the sort I'll first put down on the board. Okay, so I got this Weddigal model. I tensor it up by a one-dimensional space. Which one-dimensional space? I just consider this realization. Well, I can think of the representation at infinity in its Weddigal model. This relatively algebra cohomology is only happening at infinity. I can take this guy, which is outside, move it inside. This is an isomorphism. I tensor it by one-dimensional space. I can take this inside, and I get the full Weddigal model tensored by this coefficient system. And the space of Weddigal model is isomorphic to the space of cusp forms, which realizes this representation. Let me call it V pi. And this is exactly this pi f plus or minus. This is the automorphic. In the automorphic language, the same as the Eichler-Shimura isomorphism. Yeah. So this is. If you want to read the story in the modular world, Shimura's book on, you know, arithmetic theory of automorphic functions towards the end, chapter 8 or chapter 9, has a description of these cohomology groups. If you want to read this in the automorphic world, well, so that paper, this is a somewhat long paper, it's almost 60 pages, which explains the story for GL2 over any totally real field. So I got one side, I got the other side. Both have rational structures out of entirely different origin. On one side, via some Galois action. On the other side, coming ultimately out of singular cohomology of a locally symmetric space for GL2 and with some coefficient system. These two rational structures are totally unrelated to each other. So out of this picture pops a certain period. So these periods, so we have so this is the first part of the story, where these numbers come from. Now since there has been, the, you know, the, really the emphasis in this conference is about transcendence, maybe let me make some comments here. I didn't plan on doing so, but I just at this moment, I just decided to do so. So you can ask, are these numbers transcendental? Is there any dependence between them? Well, there is one case in which there's an obvious dependence. And I think that's the only case in which anything is known about transcendent and algebraic dependence between these numbers. What is that obvious case? Let's say this is a representation which corresponds to a modular form which has a CM type. In terms of representations, the representation is induced by a character, automorphically induced by a character of a quadratic extension. So if my pi, so there is, let's say, some quadratic extension, necessarily imaginary quadratic extension, and some character, say theta there, and pi came by automorphic induction from k to q of this character theta, then necessarily this pi admits a self-twist. It is isomorphic to itself, twisted by the quadratic character associated to this extension, quadratic character of q associated to this extension. Well, if I use this period relation, then this, and this character is of odd type, so it's going to flip the two periods. So p plus is up to quantities in the rationality, so up to some algebraic number, p minus times the Gauss sum, which is also algebraic. So p plus, so these two periods, you know, one is an algebraic multiple of the other. So if the representation is of CM type, then these are algebraically dependent. I don't think it is known in the other case. If it is not of CM type, to prove that algebraically independent. So I don't think that's known. Even for modular forms, you know, you mentioned this name Wusthols. There is some work of Wusthols in this context. And I think in the non-CM case, even for modular forms, it is unknown whether the two periods of Shimura, whether they're algebraically independent. That's what is expected, but not proved. Yes, so then the periods of the conjugated representation will be related to the periods of pi. Yeah. So there's this paper of Kumar Murthy and Dinakar Ramakrishnan, so where you prove something about Tate's conjecture. That's what I was saying. So everything I've said so far works absolutely identically for totally real number field. In fact, these period relations, I'll mention this, Shahidi and I wrote this paper, this actually works. So if I did GLN over any number field, this works, and one replaces this power by n into n minus 1 by 2. Same. That's our theorem. Okay, so I want to relate these numbers. I'm somewhat behind schedule here. To L half. So how do we prove, how do you relate these kind of numbers to the proof that L half pi is one of these periods and some suitable power of 2 pi I? So I said this proof involves giving a cohomological interpretation to the Mellin transform. Now, what's the Mellin transform? So you got this modular form phi, and the L function of this modular form is, well, it's the integral, okay, it's the completed L function. So it's basically the integral from 0 to infinity, phi of iy, y to the s minus 1 or a half, 1 maybe, dy, something like this. I want to see this integral in cohomology. Okay, that's the game. But to make sense of that, there is some work that needs to be done. That work takes the following form. It's just one diagram. Okay, so I want to show this diagram to you. And this diagram generalizes to GLN and GLN. Okay. So I start with the Wedekind model. Really, I don't care about the entire Wedekind model. I'm going to pick one very special vector, which is built out of new vectors. I'm just working with one vector. It's not the entire representation space, just one, you know. And from here, I use this Eichler-Shimura, this automorphic version of Eichler-Shimura, and land myself in cohomology with coefficients in this cusp form, twisted by some coefficient system, and some suitable sign. Now, what is this? This sits inside. Now, I told you this was the previous diagram here. One of the summands, this sits, is a summand of cuspidal cohomology. Yeah, so this goes inside cuspidal cohomology of locally symmetric space for GL2 with coefficients and with some coefficient system. Now, here comes a very important fact. Now, cusp forms decay rapidly, but the cohomology class represented by a cusp form is much better. It's represented by actually a compactly supported differential form. So in terms of cohomology groups, cuspidal cohomology injects into cohomology with compact supports. This is deep but standard, and this proof uses Borel-Sayre compactification. Okay, now I look at this line. This is a GL1 sitting in GL2. So maybe I'll do this here. I mean, what is that IY after all? It's really this imaginary line. This is, you know, you got the upper half plane and you got this line sitting in the upper half plane. What is that? That is simply an embedding of GL1 into GL2. What is the embedding? I take a Y and send it to the diagonal Y1. This is a map of algebraic groups. This works over Q. So let me call this iota. This inclusion iota induces an inclusion of locally symmetric spaces. If I have a sheaf there, I can pull it back via iota. So I got this. And more so, if I have a compact set in the upper half plane, if I intersect with this line, I am looking at a compact set in this line. In other words, this map is a proper map. So I can pull back via this map and get myself a compactly supported cohomology class for GL1 with the pullback sheaf. Next comes another very interesting detail. The fact that S equals half is critical, I'm assuming this. This in fact says something about the quotient system. This is an easy check to do. That this simply means that the representation E lambda admits the trivial representation, has the trivial representation sitting in it, and in fact sits with multiplicity 1 when restricted to GL1. Okay, so I pick some T map there. So I can go down to cohomology with constant coefficients. Okay, so I have to pull back the level structure. Now what does this look like? So one can just work this out. This is A cross mod Q cross mod all the ZP crosses. And this is nothing but positive reals. So it's just a real line. It's this line. It's just put in fancy words. It's this line. As a manifold, it's a one-dimensional manifold. And I got myself a top degree cohomology class on this one-dimensional manifold with compact supports. Poincaré duality says that if I just integrate, I fix an orientation and integrate, I get some complex number. Well, if there's any justice in this world, if I pick an appropriate Weyl-Dekker vector, land myself in cohomology, cuspidal cohomology, compact supports, pull back the GL1, constant coefficients, Poincaré duality, what should I see? There is some number, somehow canonically attached to this very special Weyl-Dekker vector. That number better be the L value. And in fact, it is. So I pick a very special vector, built out of new vectors. Consider, let me call this class something, say theta pi, I pull it back, so it's iota star theta pi, push it down to constant coefficients, so let's say it goes to t star iota star theta pi, and I integrate it. Then, maybe I'll take this off. So what one will see is the integral over GL1 of t star iota star theta pi is one. So this is the main identity to prove. There's an explicit rational number times the L value at half times, well, this Eichler-Shimura isomorphism, I have to fix this basis, one particular basis, so there's a certain complex number which comes out of that choice of basis. So you prove an identity like this. Now this might have been a rational vector, but the corresponding cohomology class need not have been rational. I can make it rational by dividing by the period. So let's say that's rational and I've divided by the period. Say I work with. And this in fact gives a proof that I got a rational class pulling back at the level of manifolds. That's a rational operation. This is at the level of sheaves. This works over Q, this map T. That's rational. Poincaré duality has nice rationality properties. So the left-hand side is a rational number. Right-hand side is an L value divided by period. And then you do an explicit computation. But this is actually a power of 2 pi i. So this is one can say that one has thought of this L value, which is, you know, some kind of Mellin transform, and I've interpreted this as an integral coming out of Poincaré duality. Now, once you have things in place, then you can prove rationality results. So my time is up. I just want to, I had planned on spending about 10 minutes on this last part. I'll just spend maybe 30 seconds, 10 seconds on each. There are different generalizations. So this is the last section. Possible generalizations. This entire story can be, you know, you can make sense of this. You should think of this as GL2, well, it's a GL2 cross GL1 story. So the first generalization is GLN cross GLN minus 1. So Shahidi and I wrote this paper on periods and period relations. It appeared in IMRM in 08. Then I proved a theorem about the central critical value for such Rankine-Selberg L functions, which was a different paper in IMRM. So both these two papers put together tell this entire story for GLN cross GLN minus 1. There one gives a cohomological interpretation to the integral representations for those L functions. In a different direction, this generalizes to L functions for GL2 and cross GL1. This is some work that I just completed. This is work with my postdoc, Harold Grobner. Where the representation of GL2N is of an interesting type. And lastly, I want to mention this somewhat long-term project of mine with Harder, which is about very general Rankine-Selberg L functions. As long as one of them, so N say is even and N prime is odd. Here, we give a cohomological interpretation to Langlands' constant term theorem. So you can, you know, so this leads on to, if we can set it up right, I think we can do this for any Langlands-Shahidi L function. So this is all work in progress, and probably will keep me busy for several years. So, okay, I'm done.